Good evening. Mum and Dad had died, and I'm sure the situation is very familiar to a number of you here in the audience today. The family home needed clearing out. We were faced with disposing of a lifetime's collection of furniture, crockery, books, jewellery, and the inevitable book of documents. And when I looked in the bottom of this big box of documents, carefully wrapped up in paper and tied with a ribbon, was a bundle of letters. Well, I quickly looked through them, and they seemed to be between my mother and father during the Second World War. So I thought, well, I was too busy to deal with them, wrapped them back up again, and took them home, put them in a drawer. Then I asked members of the family. Our eldest brother, John, lives in Sweden. I asked him, and he asked his three children and their grandchildren. I asked my sons, and Pete asked his three children, would they be at all interested in reading any of these letters? And we were astounded by the great chorus of yes we got from the family. So then there remained, how do I get them to read this big bundle of handwritten letters? So, by a strange coincidence, I was chatting a couple of years later to a lady who could type and had some time to spare. So we made an arrangement, and 3 years later, she actually emailed me the last batch of typed-up letters, and I can't thank her enough for her hard work on deciphering the handwriting and typing them all up. So we then went about the task of organising the letters into a book, which isn't as straightforward as it sounds. It's 400,000 words. It's the size of The Lord of the Rings. And there's all the photographs, which Pete helped do the photographs as well. We had 20 copies of the book printed, and we distributed them among the family. The Imperial War Museum was interested, and they have a copy. We gave a copy to the Youth Hostel Association, in which my parents were very involved, and we've got a few spares. So as a book, then, it's useful social history, as well as being a personal insight into our own family history. And today's presentation is just a tiny snapshot of what's in that book.
Dad, he was born in 1913. That's a picture of him when young. Mum was born in 1918. Dad was a keen cyclist and competed across the UK and won several medals and championships. Incidentally, that bike's got no gears. I can't believe they didn't. He was active in the Youth Hostel Association, and in these early days, that was when they were setting many of these buildings up. In terms of work, he was a clerk in the local government's waterworks department.
Whereas Mum worked in the local food health shop. We should have mentioned they both lived in Sheffield, by the way. That's where we were brought up in our early years. So she worked in the food health shop in Sheffield. But she was also, there she is, she was also a keen member of the Youth Hostel Association. They met and fell in love while they were youth hosteling. Dad was 26 and Mum just 21 when they married in June 1940, 10 months before World War II had started. 4 months later, Dad was called up and started his training at Catterick.
Now, before we give you some extracts from the letters themselves, I need to say a few words about the postal service and how it operated. You had letters that were sent by surface mail, letters that were sent by airmail, you had postcards, occasional telegrams, all combined with the little notes that got squirreled away inside parcels that went backwards and forwards. So it's a different world to Facebook and Twitter, I guess. All aspects of the postal service were run and organised by the Royal Engineers. And actually, we were surprised that so little of the information actually went astray. So all throughout the war, there was this traffic going backwards and forwards between the troops and those back home. One important note is that sometimes these letters took weeks, if not months, the letters to arrive. And obviously, from our mother's point of view, you could imagine there would have been a lot of anguish if this was an area where there's lots of fighting taking place. Because they didn't arrive necessarily in the order that things were written, sometimes it was a bit disjointed, bits of the conversation. Now, getting things through to the front wasn't that easy. You can see this is just an example of the back of a postcard, and the postcard was chasing Dad all over North Africa as he moved from one location to the next. I suppose the final thing is that it was important not to actually give away any information, that if the wrong person saw it, it might give away information that the other side could make use of. And Mum and Dad had a special code that they used where Dad was able to communicate exactly where he was. And unfortunately, although we've tried, we've not been able to decipher this, but they obviously knew how it worked.
Well, it's only possible to very briefly touch on just a few points within the stories that took 6 years to unfold, so we've left out loads of the material. But during those 6 years, Mum and Dad lived in completely different worlds. Mum as a housewife in Sheffield, and Dad obviously in the theatre of war. But we hope this comes across in the way we present their story, with snippets of news interspersed between dialogues. I read Mum's letters, and Pete's going to read Dad's letters. So to begin with, Dad was sent to Catterick to a training camp there, and Mum, who'd only been married for a few months, found herself a job near Catterick and accommodation, and she went over there so that they could spend weekends together and time off, youth hostling as they liked to. And this also meant, by the way, that they missed the Sheffield Blitz, which took place in December 1940. They were out at Catterick, fortunately, when all that was happening. Then Dad got called away, so shortly after waving Dad off on a train to Suffolk, the first letter Mum writes is, I went hostelling for the weekend. I felt that I had to do normal things as far as possible in order to keep myself properly balanced, for heaven only knows how I've pulled through this last week. To think that only a fortnight ago we were together at Catterick with no such thoughts as these. Mum then, back in Sheffield, found a job working shifts in air raid precautions. In addition, she spent time with Dad's parents, filled in for Dad's voluntary work on various youth hostel association and other committees, moved to a different house, shopped, cooked, and did all the other 101 other jobs that was made more difficult under wartime conditions. She seemed to write all or part of a letter almost every single day.
Dad sailed to the Middle East, around the south coast of Africa, via Durban, and through the Suez Canal to Cairo. The first desert campaign he was engaged in was the battle for Tobruk and the south part of the Mediterranean in North Africa. Now, the Germans' objective at the time was to take Egypt, because the military needed oil and these key resources for the vehicles of war, and their plan was to get into the Middle East through Egypt. And certainly for the early part of that, under their leadership of Field Marshal Rommel, they inflicted very heavy casualties on the British and Allied forces. And everything sort of built up to one huge battle that took place in the middle of the North African coast at El Alamein. And here's one of the first quotes from Dad on the 5th of January 1942. "There's so little I can write and tell you. There's nothing I can say except that I'm safe and well, reasonably comfortable, and longing more than ever to get back home.
Hello, my sweetheart. I've just finished a 13-page letter, but I suppose it'll be weeks before you get it. I keep looking for news, sweetheart, but I've got my fingers crossed, for I'm sure you're okay. I always know that, just as I can always feel when you're in trouble."
Dad's next letter was on the 15th of January, but it didn't arrive until May of that year, in 1942. "As you know, the push commenced on the 17th of November, and when we were still some way back in the rear picking up our tanks, After seeing what Jerry did to the other squadrons, I'm damn glad we were the last. We picked up our tanks on the 20th and started the last run up the Libyan border. Then the fun commenced. A Nazi armoured column had broken through and was running around the back area, through which we were moving, creating merry hell amongst our supply vehicles. We hunted that blasted column for a week. He'd be 6 miles one side and then 8 the other, and so on. And of course, he could move much faster than our heavy tanks. We were up and on the move every day before dawn, in the tank at action stations all day with just a snatch meal of biscuits and bully, make camp and at dusk, do maintenance until 11 or 12 o'clock, adjusting, oiling, refueling, etc. All mucky jobs. A rub of cotton waste over the hands, off with the overalls, into the blankets until 5 a.m., then off again. Gosh, darling, you should have seen us after a week of that. Unwashed, unshaven, half-fed.
I'm sorry to hear you're not receiving my letters, so I'm sending this in the hope that it'll reach you sooner. And incidentally, your airmails of late have taken 7 weeks. This may be due to extra Christmas mail. Aerographs are only taking about 15 days.
We found a place to park our tanks, climbed out, just going to start a fire to make a meal, when wee bang, wee bang. One shell dropped about 20 yards one side of the tank, another about the same on the other side. I don't quite know how it happened, but I was inside that tank with the lid down before the next shell started firing. The enemy held rings of trenches, Italians in the shallow outer rings and Nazis in the centre rings, having deep, well-constructed ones with plenty of anti-tank guns and machine gun nests. Right in the centre was a triangle of big guns. Lucky for us, our artillery had put most of them out of action the day or so before. The whole area was surrounded by minefields, so we just kept running around the trenches.
I don't think I mentioned it before, but transport fares have now been increased. Ecclesall to Dore is tuppence halfpenny. It doesn't sound much, but it's just one of those things that make banking accounts a dream these days. These little extras seem to come from everywhere.
We got the remaining big guns before any of our tanks were hit. The Italians in the outer trenches soon surrendered. The Nazis in the inner ring kept us busy all day. We kept coming out, checking over the track, refueling, refilling with ammo, and in again. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we came out for the last time because our tracks were badly damaged, and, lucky for us, we just crawled back alongside our tent when one track broke. 20 minutes earlier, and we'd have been parked right in the enemy lines. When we first went in, all I could think of was you, mother and father, and the effects of a Jerry 6-inch shell. When battle began, I'd no time to think of anything at all. I was load, reload, and reload again. I was scared stiff at the thoughts of going in, yet somehow, once in, one seemed to forget about personal danger. One just concentrated on the game in hand. Next morning, they surrendered, what was left of them, about 250 Germans and a few Italians.
Friday, I had to go to town in the morning to do all my shopping, pay the electric and gas, etc. But really, there's nothing to buy. All the fruit shops look lovely, full of flowers. I'm looking for a good recipe for flour pie.
The column of prisoners came past our lines, poor devils. They looked just about as fed up as ourselves. However, for them, their war was over. We went round their trenches next day. They appeared to have ample of everything, water, food, ammo, guns, etc. They have much drinking water, a special brand of spa water in 2-pint bottles, lovely stuff. I drank a whole bottle in about 10 minutes. Best water I've tasted since I left home.
I'm going to sell the old washer and get a nice tabletop wringer with a tub. According to newspaper adverts, I should be investing the money in savings certificates. But the trouble is, you can't squeeze clothes with certificates, can you?
Next morning, we finished a leisurely brekker, and about nine, an infantry officer stopped to have a chat with us. What, no food, he said. About half a mile over there, there's a Jerry food dump. As soon as he had gone, we made a beeline for the dump. What a place. Rows and rows of cases. Meat, vegetables, cheese, fruit. Enough tinned food to feed thousands. We loaded up the tank and set off back to Brook.
I'm not so bad off as some, though, for I've got a garden and I'm almost self-supporting greens and salads. And there are some spring onions coming up, too. They're pretty valuable at sixpence per bunch for 5 onions.
There's not much more to tell you. Our battalion came back from Demmer and arrived on New Year's Eve. Next day, we all went to our squadrons, and a number of us were immediately transferred to A and B to replace their casualties.
Now, Dad does try to make quite light of the second bout of conflict, which is the second battle of El Alamein, which ended on the 3rd of November.
This is an airmail letter sent on the 10th. Good morning, my darling. We were all sat alongside the tank, chatting and swatting flies, when whee, bang, we'd just time to duck and were all under the tank, me swearing and cursing like hell and holding my arm. A piece of shrapnel about the size of an OXO cube had caught me right on my funny bone. I couldn't use my arm for a couple of hours afterwards. Luckily, was nearly spent and didn't penetrate. I hope to be back with you, with the unit shortly. And then, whoopee, all my back mail for the last few weeks. I'll have writer's cramp, you hope.
The news from Libya is very disturbing. I do hope, darling, you're not in the thick of it this time. Do take care of yourself. Now, both of us had assumed that the whole British population would have been fired up and working their socks off to support the war effort. So we were quite surprised to read in the letters the following two issues in these letters. And the first is about how many strikes there were. Easter 1943. Hello, sweetheart. Yes, Easter Sunday and I'm working Saturday, Sunday and Monday. That's nothing, but the ruddy transport department needs to go on strike. Not a tram, not a bus. I went off duty at 8 o'clock this morning and it took me an hour and a half to get home. I know what I'd do with the ringleaders of this strike. It would be in the army for them with no hesitation. It's nothing short of sabotage.
What is happening? We keep getting news of strikes here, there and everywhere. The general opinion of the lads out here is shoot the bees.
Strikes are becoming increasingly common these days. My opinion is very low. It's nothing short of murder.
If those men knew what it means to see your pals killed and wounded because they had to go into battle armed with inadequate guns and equipment, we know the difference between attacking 88s with two-pounders and with 75s. It's all the difference between life and death.
Now, the second issue that we came across in the letter is about conscientious objectors. Before he had gone away, Dad had offered to help two of his oldest friends, Eric, who was a conscientious objector, and his wife, Renée. So they moved in with Mum while Dad was away, and this caused a bit of friction, and eventually Mum asked them to leave. This upset Dad. But it's interesting to see how Mum and Dad battered the argument to and fro before they understood each other's position.
Probably I'm partly to blame for the trouble because I gave them to understand that we'd do anything to help them in their need of assistance.
Well, you may be great friends. You may have hostled with them, camped with them, but you haven't lived with them. If they had lost their home through reasons beyond their control, I could understand it. But Eric's just blind stupid. He prattles on about this being a capitalist war. What about the USSR? Does he think they're fighting for capitalism? Can't he see that this is a life and death struggle for freedom?
What's this phrase in your letter? I'm not likely to change my opinions during or after the war. Just read that bit again, Ducks. Since when have we admitted that anything, even your opinions, are fixed and unchanging?
Well, Renée left here on Monday, and in spite of the fact that you're displeased with me, I'm not sorry they've gone. I propose we leave the whole matter until you come home. Renée and I parted friends, and I talked with Eric last night at the YHA opening night.
This is where I have to make an apology. I should have placed far greater trust in your insight and knowledge. It's impossible to stomach passive resistance to a mad dog when you know what will happen if he overpowers you. I also would have changed from the views I held in 1942 and realise now I couldn't live long with a person of such different views. We'll leave it there, but I've hardly left enough room to tell you I still love you more and more.
Well, the North Africa campaign was over and Dad returned home for a few weeks before being sent to Normandy about 60 days after D-Day. Sometime during this period, he travelled to Glasgow to pick up his new tank, a Comet. Now, the Finiston crane was one of the few cranes in the UK that at that time capable of lifting such a load. This new British tank was fast, well-armed and protected, and for the first time, Dad felt he had a machine that was a match for the German Panzer and Tiger tanks. He spent the summer and, well, can you explain the...
Oh, right, sorry, this is a map, I just took it off Google Maps. So he'd have come down from Glasgow, they went over to the Normandy beaches shortly after the Normandy landings, and they had a number of skirmishes around Caen in Normandy. From there, he moved up through France. No, back a slide, Sue. Yeah, moved up through Normandy, Belgium, Netherlands. He finished the war at Lübeck, up in the north of Germany. But the next slide just shows, these red dots here show some of the skirmishes they were involved in down there.
He spent the summer and autumn camped in a muddy orchard near Caen in Normandy before moving north with the Fife and Forfar Yeomanry.
In November 1944, Dad wrote, "We got into northeastern France across the Seine, and the character of the country changes. Welcome smiles, folks coming to the doors, and as the convoy passes, waving and shouting, bon voyage and good luck. We stopped for a short halt. A woman comes running out of her house with a basket of apples. They're all given out, and she runs back for more. Another man appears with a couple of bottles of wine, which he pours into our mugs. Next morning, you find that not only have your boots been cleaned, but your socks amended, and, ah, monsieur, if only you were staying another day, we would wash your clothes. This afternoon, I had an unexpected pleasure. I fired my first shot into Germany. Don't know what I hit, but one can't go wrong. Now we're playing them at their own game. 1st of April, 1945. Good morning, precious. As you say, the news is good and getting better, but really don't be too optimistic about a sudden ending. There may be white flags on all the houses when you've passed a place, but until then, it's a case of look out or else. There was one town about the size of York. They decided to defend it to the last German. They did. It took the RAF just 12 minutes. When we went through, you couldn't find the barricades they'd been in. You couldn't find the street. You couldn't even see any aspect of the street. All you could tell was where the town had given place to fields, where the rubble ended. This is our first real contact with the German civilians. Uppermost in all our minds is this question of fraternization. I suppose, as usual, we shall solve the problem by some form of compromise. Soon after we pulled in last night, we decide to have a kick around at football in the hour before dark. The ball is down and we've no pump, so I have to ask the locals for a pump, which they bring, and then they all look on, mother, father, half dozen kids, while we kick a ball around in the field. The guard is mounted. They stand and watch. We have our supper. They still watch. Always they are looking at us as if they can't believe their own eyes. The same look of bewilderment on the face of many we pass each day as the endless stream of tanks and lorries go passing by. The call comes. Naffy rations up. Come and get it. We come away from the truck with our chocolate and cigarettes. I don't know about the other chaps, but I know I'm very conscious of six pairs of children's eyes looking at me, and my two bars of chocolate, and whatever nationality, children are still children. We just ignore, look indifferent, answer the gaze with military sternness, frown at their smiles. But all the time, we're pulling on a play act. It's so foreign to our nature to kick a fallen enemy, and equally foreign to ignore a human being. I don't know how long it'll last, this non-fraternization business, but I do know it's far more difficult than straightforward fighting.
Well, Mum had her own views about fraternisation and found Dad's letter rather confusing. After years of propaganda, reading pictures of atrocities, etc., you feel confused when the first family you met were, to all intents and purposes, normal people. Well, I had the advantage or disadvantage of not being disturbed by their friendly smiles and hearing the voices of German children. I believe the pictures I have seen of piles of bodies waiting to be burnt, nothing but skin and bone and showing all the marks of their unspeakable tortures. This has not been done by a handful of persons, or by people who've done it half-heartedly. You say they stand and stare with bewildered faces when they see Allied armour pouring through their towns. Do you wonder? They've believed for years that they're superior in weapons and men, and now they're suddenly afraid of all the awful things they've done. They will lie to try and save their skins, but I'm afraid they'll have to be very sincere to be believed.
Tuesday, 10th of April, 1945. Today we're having a rest day, our first since crossing the Rhine. Yesterday we were very busy. We were the leading squadron and reached a large village held by a company of SS. When it was obvious there was strong opposition, the following units bypassed the place and left us behind to clear it up. We surrounded the place and sent in a loudspeaker van, but there was no reply to our offer of surrender. For the next 20 minutes, our artillery, tanks and mortars gave them all we could. There was a pleasant village, red roofs amongst the trees. Then there was hell let loose, and smoke and dust obscuring the sun. 3 hours later, the smoke was clearing nicely, and we saw there were still several houses not on fire. Traverse right, machine gun, 500 yards, right-hand house, halfway down the roof, fire, and 5 minutes later it was ablaze. A few civilians and two or three soldiers had staggered out. The latter were identified as the same company of SS that had captured 40 of our accompanying infantrymen and then shot them 4 days ago. That did it. We gave them another pounding, and then the infantry went in, penetrating from one pile of smoking rubble to the next one. As they neared the end of the village, about 20 Boche suddenly broke and ran for cover to the woods, 2 field lengths away. Well, we'd been waiting for that for over 6 hours, for just such a move, and that was the end of them. The infantry followed up and checked up. We lined up, ready to move, and noticed one or two heads bobbing. We trimmed our guns and waited. One or two civilians bobbed up, then more. Then one chap started to run towards us, and several followed. 5 minutes later, you couldn't see the tank for a mass of people, shouting, cheering, shaking hands, Greeks, French, Dutch, and every nationality in Europe, so it seemed, looking at us, smiling, patting the tank, laughing, crying, some too overcome to speak, others jabbering away excitedly. And on the 22nd of April, 1945, good morning, darling. I've had quite a shock last night when I checked up on my diary and found that it was 12 days since my last letter. I thought it was only 5 or 6, but things have been moving so fast that it's only been possible to concentrate on the bare essentials of food and sleep. From first light to dusk, it's been action stations. We had a number of reinforcements a fortnight ago. One lad went on leave, and his place was taken by a new chap, a lad of 19, who had had less than 6 months in the army and only left England in March. Next day, he was killed when an 88 hit the tank. One of the survivors of the crew had been in the army since 1939 and had 4 years with the 8th in MEF, yet all he had got was a broken finger. Funny thing, this luck business. You may have read about the horrors of the Belsen typhus camp near Bremen. Well, we were the first troops into that place. Also, we've met and spoken with many of the lads who've marched from Poland to the west and then were marching east again under their Nazi guards. They escaped at night and hid in the woods until we came. They'd no need to tell their stories. One look at their faces and their feet. These tanks of ours are good and proof against most things, but unfortunately not watertight, and when it rains one might as well stand under a waterfall. The whole turret top stem seems to act like a drain through the hatches. Apparently our division was the first British unit to reach the Elbe, and we were the leading regiment that day. A squadron were in the lead, and mine was the leading tank, so I guess I can say I helped make a little history that last Friday afternoon. We'd cut the main road, pushed south of Lüneburg the previous day, guarded it all night, and then the next day pushed northeast to bypass the town. Our RAF spotters reported the Nazis fleeing down the roads towards the river, so we were ordered to cut off the town at all speed. We swung east by tracks through the woods, and then tore down the road, 4 tanks abreast, flat out. It was crazy tactics, but it paid. Before they knew what had happened, we were taking the Germans prisoner as they retreated out of the town. We were on our way to Denmark when the standstill order came. a few days ago.
At 3 p.m., they announced Germany's unconditional surrender. After all these years, it seems hard to believe. I wish I knew just where you were, darling, and what you were doing. I wish I could talk to you for just 5 minutes.
Hello, darling. It looks as though it's happened at last. After all these years of fighting, we got the news last night that Germans in this area had agreed to surrender. Everybody went mad, cheering, shouting, firing our guns into the air as it happened. We had a good drop of wine, etc., in the squadron, and by 10 o'clock there was only about half a dozen of us still sober. I turned in and had my first night's sleep since we crossed the Elbe last week. Today life goes on as usual, except that there's no more push on business, no more leading tank, no more sudden death. 4 of the chaps in my troop were killed only 2 days ago when we bumped up against the 2 Tiger tanks defending the road to Lübeck. I don't think there's any chance now of our doing any more fighting, so all that remains is having to put up with army life until I get discharged. I still can't get used to the feeling of no longer living on the edge of eternity.
Well, ducks, today is a happy day. We shall celebrate, and then we shall start work again. We shall work to finish the war in the Far East, win the peace, and then perhaps this beastly thing called war will not shadow our lives again. Cheerio, sweetheart. Good luck. And remember that you are in all our hearts today. All my love and kisses on paper at present, Olga. Now, it might be difficult to believe from some of that war correspondence that Dad was actually quite a romantic. He wrote some very moving poetry, especially during the desert campaigns in 1941. But here's a lighter poem that he wrote in 1945, which seems to summarise this book of letters, and it's called You and I.
You and I, and me and you, how we are and what we do, of whom we think, to whom we talk, of what we dream, with whom we walk. Where we went last week, last night, of things that came within our sight, what we hope to do tomorrow, greetings, yearnings, joy and sorrow. Relations, news and neighbours' chatters, gardening notes, financial matters, these the content of our days, tell of parting, broken ways. Writing, words and phrases, when all we crave are love's embraces, when only then all fascists ceased, will we together live in peace.
Thank you very much.